The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Okay, so if you hear dinosaur and immediately picture, you know, those big, slow, green things wading through swamps, just sort of waiting to go extinct, well, get ready for a major update. We're about to cut through a lot of that old cultural baggage.
Definitely. We're diving into the work of Dr. David Norman, who's really fundamental to how we understand dinosaurs today. Think of this deep dive as like a shortcut to understanding the dinosaur renaissance.
The dinosaur renaissance. I like that. So this was the big shift starting back in the 60s, right? They completely changed how science saw these animals.
Exactly. It completely flipped the script.
So our mission today: explore Norman's big idea that dinosaurs weren't failures at all, but were actually incredibly dynamic, sophisticated, and maybe the most successful land animals ever. That's the core of it. We'll look at how paleontology, using all sorts of modern tools, chemistry, physics, tech, pieced together their lives and proved they were rulers, not just, you know, lumbering towards extinction.
160 million years.
Yeah.
It's hard to even grasp that time frame. And Norman really shows the science behind it all, the actual process of figuring this stuff out.
Precisely. It's about the rigor behind the wonder.
Okay, so who is this expert, David Norman, who's guiding us through this huge rethink?
Right. So Dr. David Norman, he's based at Cambridge University, director of the Sedgwick Museum of Earth Sciences there. And he spent, well, over 40 years studying these amazing creatures.
40 years? That's some serious dedication. Does he have a particular focus?
He does. He's a top authority on the ornithischians. Those are the bird-hipped dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And his work on Iguanodon, you know, the famous one Gideon Mantell discovered early on, is really seminal.
Iguanodon, okay.
But what makes Norman's perspective so valuable, I think, is his ability to connect the dots. He's done field work all over the world, real hands-on stuff. But he also has this knack for explaining the big shifts in thinking, like the whole dinosaur-bird connection, making it understandable for, well, for everyone.
So he wasn't just reading about this revolution, he was actually part of it, pushing the field forward.
Absolutely. He was right in the thick of it, challenging those older Victorian ideas. His work inherently questions those long-held assumptions, which makes him perfectly placed to tell this story of dinosaur success.
Let's dig into that central message then, because saying they were one of evolution's greatest success stories, that really turns the common idea on its head, doesn't it? Why the focus on success, not extinction?
What's the sheer timescale? I mean, dominating land ecosystems for over 160 million years. It's just staggering.
Yeah, put that in perspective for us.
Okay, so our species, Homo sapiens, we've been around maybe 300,000 years, right? If you compressed the entire Mesozoic era, the age of dinosaurs, into a single 24-hour day, all of recorded human history would be like less than the last second before midnight.
Wow. Okay. That certainly reframes things. So evolutionary failure doesn't really fit, does it? They were only taken out by, well, a cosmic catastrophe, not because they were inherently flawed.
That's exactly Norman's point. His whole purpose is to replace those, you know, pop culture myths, slow, stupid, doomed, with the actual scientific picture, which is far more impressive.
And the book takes us through the whole journey, from the very first discoveries to the latest science.
It's incredibly comprehensive, yeah. Starts with the history, you know, figuring out who these bones belong to, how Richard Owen came up with the name Dinosauria,
right.
Then dives into their biology, anatomy, metabolism, how fast they grew, evidence for complex behavior. And then, yeah, it covers the dramatic end for most of them,
yeah.
But also the incredible story of survival, which is the bird connection.
Okay, let's start right at the beginning then. We throw the word dinosaur around all the time, but Norman gives a really precise scientific definition. What actually makes a dinosaur and not, say, one of those big swimming reptiles?
It really boils down to one key thing, their posture.
Posture.
Yeah. When Richard Owen defined Dinosauria back in 1842, he noticed something unique about the hip structure in the fossils he was looking at. It forced the legs to be positioned directly underneath the body, an erect stance.
Ah, okay. So not sprawling out to the sides like a crocodile or a lizard.
Exactly. Think more like a horse or an elephant. Well, a bird.
Yeah.
Legs straight down, supporting the body from below. This is a major evolutionary innovation. It allows for much more efficient movement, sustained activity, even running fast.
So that's the crucial takeaway for you listening.
Ah.
If it didn't have that specific hip structure and upright stance, it wasn't technically a dinosaur. Those marine reptiles like plesiosaurs or the flying pterosaurs,
oh.
Fascinating creatures, contemporaries, but not dinosaurs.
Precisely. It lists the definition way beyond just big extinct reptile. It's a specific evolutionary group defined by this anatomical feature.
But that erect posture, that more active lifestyle, it begs a huge question, doesn't it? One that really fueled the dinosaur renaissance. How did they power that? Which brings us to the metabolism debate. Were they cold-blooded like modern reptiles or warm-blooded like us?
Right, the ectotherm versus endotherm question. And it's complicated. Norman lays out pretty strong evidence pointing towards a relatively high metabolism.
Like what?
Well, first, as you said, that erect posture itself is energetically costly. You need a decent engine to maintain that. Second, there's the bone histology.
Bone histology.
Yeah, looking at the microscopic structure of fossil bones. Dinosaur bones often show patterns of really fast, sustained growth, kind of like modern birds and mammals. They have these things called avergent canals, which are linked to rapid remodeling and growth fueled by a higher metabolism. Plus, we find dinosaurs in polar regions.
Right, places that would have been pretty chilly even back then. But it's not a simple warm-blooded answer, is it? Especially for the absolutely massive ones.
No, it seems more nuanced. Norman suggests maybe a strategy called mesothermy.
Mesothermy.
Kind of a middle ground. Not fully cold-blooded, relying entirely on the environment for heat, but maybe not maintaining a constant high internal temperature like mammals do either. Think maybe like some large sharks or tunas today. They could generate and conserve some body heat, allowing for sustained activity and faster growth, but perhaps without the extreme energy costs of full endothermy.
Which would make sense for an 80-ton sauropod, right? Maybe they didn't need to eat constantly just to stay warm.
Exactly. It might have been a very efficient strategy for their scale and lifestyle.
And this complexity, it didn't just stop at their biology, it extended into their behavior too. That old image of the solitary, dim-witted brute really got smashed, didn't it? Tell us about Mayasaura.
Yes. The Mayasaura discovery in Montana, they nicknamed the site Egg Mountain that was absolutely revolutionary. It provided the first really solid proof of complex parental care.
How so?
They found nests built closely together, like colonies. And inside those nests, they found baby dinosaurs that were clearly too large to have just hatched, and their teeth showed wear. It meant the young stayed in the nest for a significant time after hatching, and the parents must have been bringing them food.
So they weren't just laying eggs and leaving like most reptiles do. They were actively raising their young.
Precisely. They were altricial, meaning the babies were quite helpless at birth, requiring dedicated care. That's much more like birds than typical reptiles.
That's a huge behavioral shift in our understanding.
Absolutely. And it's not just nesting sites. We also have fossil trackways footprints preserved in ancient mud. Sometimes you find tracks of many individuals, different sizes, all moving in the same direction, parallel to each other. That's strong evidence for herding behavior, social groups moving together.
So definitely not just solitary beasts. They had complex social lives.
It seems very likely, yes. A socially complex dynasty.
Okay, connecting that back to the bigger evolutionary picture, Norman maps out the sheer scale of this dynasty, and there's a fundamental split in the dinosaur family tree, right? Established way back in 1887 by Harry Seeley.
That's right. It all comes down to the hips again, interestingly. Seeley divided them into two major groups based on the arrangement of their pelvic bones.
Which are?
You have the Saurischia, which means lizard-hipped. Ironically, this group includes the ancestors of birds, but it mainly covers the giant long-necked sauropods like Brontosaurus and Diplodocus, and also all the bipedal carnivores, the theropods like T-Rex and Velociraptor.
Okay, lizard-hipped, and the other group?
The Ornithischia, meaning bird-hipped. Their hip structure looks superficially more like that of modern birds, though birds didn't evolve from this group. This includes pretty much all the plant eaters except the sauropods. So the armored dinosaurs like Stegosaurus and Ankylosaurus, the horned ones like Triceratops, the duck-billed hadrosaurs like Mayasaura.
Got it. So Saurischia, sauropods, and theropods. Ornithischia, everyone else, basically all the other herbivores. And Norman makes it clear this branching led to incredible variety, right?
Absolutely breathtaking variety, from chicken-sized predators to giants stretching longer than a blue whale. Armored tanks, horned battlers, feathered hunters, they filled nearly every conceivable terrestrial niche, large and small, across the globe for that entire 160 million year span. That is the definition of evolutionary success, high adaptability.
Irrefutable proof, really, but as you said, even the most successful reigns eventually end. Let's talk about the catastrophe, the KPG boundary event 66 million years ago. How does Norman cover the evidence for the asteroid impact?
He lays out very clearly. The key breakthrough came from the father-son team, Luis Malter Alvarez, in the late 70s, early 80s. They were studying a thin layer of clay found globally right at the geological boundary marking the end of the Cretaceous period.
And they found something unusual in it.
Something very unusual. Extremely high levels of the element iridium. Now, iridium is very rare in Earth's crust, but it's much more abundant in asteroids and comets. Finding this global spike in iridium, precisely dated to 66 million years ago? Well, that was the first big clue, pointing to a massive extraterrestrial impact event.
The fingerprint of an asteroid. But they needed more, right? The actual impact site.
Exactly. The smoking gun, and they found it. Or rather, the evidence converged on it. A massive impact crater, about 180 kilometers wide, buried partly under the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico and the adjacent Gulf of Mexico. Mm. It's called the Chicxulub Crater, and its age matches the KPG boundary perfectly.
So a huge asteroid, maybe 10 kilometers wide, slams into the Earth. What were the immediate effects?
Utter devastation. Mm. Tsunamis, global wildfires ignited by falling debris. But the killer blow, according to the models, was the atmospheric effect. Huge amounts of dust, soot from the fires, and sulfur aerosols were blasted into the stratosphere.
Creating a kind of impact winter.
Exactly. It would have blocked sunlight for months, maybe years. Photosynthesis would have collapsed worldwide. Plants die. Herbivores starve. Carnivores starve.
Yet.
The entire global food chain just unravels. And the non-avian dinosaurs, especially the large ones at the top, they just couldn't survive it.
Which brings us to maybe the most profound part of Norman's narrative, the dinosaur-bird connection. If the impact wiped out the dinosaurs, how can we still talk about the dynasty surviving?
Because not all dinosaurs died out. The science is overwhelming now. Birds are living dinosaurs.
Not just descended from them, but actually are them.
Yes. They are a specific lineage of theropod dinosaurs, the same group as T-Rex and Velociraptor, that survived the extinction event. We have stunning fossil evidence, especially from Liaoning province in China, showing small theropods covered in feathers.
Feathers, but not necessarily for flight initially.
Probably not. Fossils like Sinoceropteryx show simple, filament-like feathers, likely used for insulation, maybe display. More complex, veined feathers evolved later, eventually co-opted for flight in the lineage that led to modern birds. So feathers came long before flight. It fundamentally changes how we see dinosaurs and how we see birds. The lost world isn't entirely lost.
Wow. Okay, let's shift gears a bit. What are the big picture lessons we can take away from this whole scientific revolution that Norman documents? The first thing that jumps out is science as self-correction.
Oh, absolutely. That's perhaps the most vital lesson here. Mm-hmm. Think about it. The image of dinosaurs completely transformed from Richard Owen's slow lizard-like giants in the 19th century to John Ostrom's work on Deinonychus in the 1960s, which revealed this agile, active, likely warm-blooded predator. That's a massive shift driven purely by new evidence and reevaluation.
So the takeaway for us, for you listening, is about intellectual humility, right? Being willing to question what we think we know, even deeply held beliefs, when better evidence comes along. Science corrects itself.
Exactly. And that correction process relies heavily on the second theme, the integration of evidence. Paleontology isn't just about digging up bones anymore.
Right. Norman shows it's become incredibly interdisciplinary.
Totally. It uses chemistry analyzing isotopes in teeth to figure out diet or ancient climates. It uses physics biomechanical modeling to understand how a T-Rex could move or how a long neck was supported. It uses computer science CT scans to look inside fossils without damaging them, creating virtual models.
It's like a detective story using every possible forensic tool.
It really is. And the reflection there is that complex problems, whether in science or business or anything else, often need that interdisciplinary approach. The best insights come when you combine different perspectives and tools.
And the third big theme that comes through so strongly is that success is adaptation, not stasis. Their incredible 160 million year run proves just how adaptable dinosaurs were.
Yes. They weren't just sitting around unchanging. They constantly evolved, diversified, adapted to shifting continents and climates. Their extinction wasn't because they were inherently bad designs or failures. It took a planet-altering catastrophe to end their dominance.
So the lesson is that long-term success in any system, biological or otherwise, comes from adaptability, from being able to respond effectively to changing conditions. Stasis is fragility.
Well put. The KPG event is a stark reminder that even the most dominant players can be vulnerable to sudden, drastic environmental change.
Okay, let's highlight some of the core ideas or memorable lines that really capture Norman's perspective.
Well, the one that directly tackles that old narrative is something like, dinosaurs were not evolutionary failures condemned to extinction, but rather represent one of the most successful groups of animals ever to have lived on Earth.
That just flips the script, doesn't it? It forces you to redefine success based on longevity and dominance, not just on who's around now. It really challenges our sort of mammal-centric bias, perhaps.
I think so. Another key idea is about the nation of the evidence itself. Something along the lines of, the fossil record is not a complete library of the history of life, but rather a collection of torn pages scattered through time.
I love that analogy. It really emphasizes the detective work involved, doesn't it? You're working with fragments, hints, clues. You have to infer so much.
Exactly. It highlights the challenges, the uncertainties, but also the ingenuity required in the field. You can't know everything, so you build the best picture you can from the available pieces.
And finally, the one that really sticks with you, the paradigm shift. Birds are not descendants of dinosaurs. Birds are dinosaurs, the only surviving lineage of a once mighty dynasty.
That's the mind blower, right? It connects this ancient, seemingly vanished world directly to the present day.
Dinosaurs are still here, flitting around our gardens.
It changes how you look at a pigeon forever.
Yeah.
Okay, thinking practically now, how can we apply the way Norman approaches his science to our own lives?
Well, one clear application is using his method as a critical thinking framework.
Huh. Look at how paleontologists debated the metabolism question, for instance. They didn't just jump to conclusions. They gathered multiple lines of evidence. Bone structure, posture, predator-prey ratios, geographic distribution, and systematically tested different hypotheses. We can apply that same rigor in our own lives. Question assumptions, demand evidence, look for corroboration before accepting something as fact.
It's about avoiding those easy answers and really digging into the why, resisting jumping to conclusions based on incomplete data.
Precisely. And then there's the obvious link to environmental awareness. Studying the KPG extinction. I mean, it's a sobering case study.
Yeah, seeing how a sudden global environmental catastrophe could wipe out even the planet's dominant species. It certainly puts our current climate and biodiversity crises into a much sharper perspective, doesn't it?
It underscores the fragility of complex ecosystems and the potential for rapid, irreversible change. It reminds us that even dominant species aren't immune to environmental collapse.
And a third application is about innovation.
Definitely. Paleontology is an old field, right? Goes back centuries. But look how it's been revitalized by embracing new technologies, CT scanning, genetic analysis for inferring ancestral traits, computer modeling. Norman's work implicitly shows how adopting new tools and techniques can completely revolutionize even a very traditional discipline.
It's a lesson for any field, really. Don't get stuck in old methods. Be open to how new tools can open up new questions and answers.
So for me, wrapping up, the most insightful thing from Norman's work is really understanding the dynamic, progressive nature of science itself. Knowledge isn't static. It evolves. What we thought was true about dinosaurs 50 years ago has been radically updated. It encourages that intellectual humility we talked about.
Yeah, that constant revision is key. For me, the most surprising thing is probably that visceral connection to deep time and realizing the continuity. Knowing that the sparrow outside my window is, in a very real sense, a dinosaur. It collapses time in a way. It makes the ancient world feel less other, less disconnected. It's still part of our world, just in a different form. It definitely changes how you see things. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Apatra Foundation.